Good afternoon. Welcome to the New York Public Library and to our celebration of Abraham Lincoln, the second most famous president ever, at least so far. My name is John Peters. I'm the head of the Children's Center at 42nd Street, and I would like to welcome you to the brand new New York Public Library, as well as today's celebration. Today we are leading off at a very high level with Barry Denenberg, an author of historical fiction and nonfiction, whose books are on the shelves of every library that has any sort of self-respect at all. And some of them you will find on the table over here. More of them you will find on the shelves in the Children's Center. And I invite you to visit us after his talk and see for yourself. Mr. Denenberg has written titles in both the Dear America and My Name is America series of historical fiction. He has also done excellent biographies of Charles Lindbergh, of John Fitzgerald Kennedy, and many other people. And today he's here to talk about his newest, which has the tantalizing title of Lincoln Shot. And it also has the tantalizing appearance of one of the largest books that I personally have ever seen. Right here on the stage is an example of it. And I am, for one, am looking forward to hearing his insights and having him explain to us why it is that Abraham Lincoln is so famous. Mr. Denenberg.
Well, thank you. And let me start off by saying I don't usually do anything like this. So I'm a little nervous. I do not have, although if many of you remember the commercial years ago where they made shadows with their hands, I don't have a visual presentation. As a matter of fact, when I was invited here, I was in such a panic that I called up my daughter, Emma, who volunteered to accompany me here, and I asked her for her advice, because I remember all those times she came home from school when she was in fourth, fifth, and sixth grade, and she said, "Oh, we heard the most boring speaker today, Daddy." And I said, "Who was it?" And it would be somebody really terrific. And I would say, "Why were they so boring?" So I called up Emma, and I said, "What is your advice?" And Emma said, "Be brief, be funny, and be personal." So I'm going to tell you two jokes. And these are the two funniest jokes ever. But I want you to pay attention, especially you guys in the front row. Kid comes home from school one day, and his grandfather is sitting in the living room in his robe and slippers, and he's watching television. The kid says to his grandfather, "What are you watching?" And the grandfather says, "Basketball." And the kid says, "What's the score?" The grandfather says, 86-85. The kid says, "Who's winning?" And the grandfather says, 86. Now, you, what? Who wants to hear the second joke? No one. Okay, so we'll just go on. Second joke is good, but all right. Now, what I'd really like to do, although I do have a 500-page speech that I could ring, which I prepared last night, frankly, the few times I do this, I would really rather have questions and go from there. If you don't want to do that, I have a list of questions I've been asked over the years from the letters I get. We can do it that way. But if anybody has any questions on either topics, why I write, what it's like to be a writer, what the challenges of writing books for children today, which is an interesting topic, why we did Lincoln Shot the way we did it, what the problems were with it, or anything you want to talk about Lincoln or the Civil War, I'd be happy to go from there. So does anybody have any questions? What's your name?
Joanne.
Joanne. Hi. Well, that's a really good question, and we were kind of talking about it a little before. Did everyone hear the question? Yes, I think you're supposed to do that. The question, which I think I remember, is what are the challenges and what is it like writing for children today? Has it changed since I've been writing? And anything else I have to add? I go back to my childhood, and I was someone who liked reading biographies. There was a series, I grew up in the early 1840s, there was a series called Landmark Books, which I think was published by Random House, if I remember. And I used to read all of them. And I actually remember something which relates to my experience with Lincoln that's kind of eerie, is I grew up in Brooklyn. You people still know, do you know where Brooklyn is? Where are you from? You too. You from local? New York. You know where, you know, Brooklyn? Okay, I was born in Brooklyn. I'm always on the wrong side of the tracks. And my grandparents, I was very close to my grandparents, and they always used to take me to the library. When I was 8, they took me to a library in Brooklyn. I came in, and I was I'm not a precocious person, a show-off. I'm not a show-off, but I really was someone who read an intense a lot of books. And I now realize I read Bruce Catton's The Stillness at Appomattox when I was 8 by accident, that I didn't know it wasn't a kid's book. And I remember being totally flipped out about Grant and Lee and the surrender at Appomattox. And I was almost transported there to that moment. Now, I now realize, having researched the Civil War for the last 5 years, why, and it's something I try to translate into my book. To get back to your question, I don't know what's happened, and I think it predates the computer, but it seems to me that children, students, are not reading history or biographies like they used to, certainly to some degree, and that's the most judicious thing I could say. That's a problem. I taught fifth grade a few years ago in Stamford, Connecticut, taught history and did a writing program there. Loved the kids. It was K through 5. I actually established the library there, ordered it, actually funded it myself. And we had a good library, we had a good book situation, and there was not one kid who read anything but fiction. Now, I'm not against fiction. I used to have a great American fiction collection. There is something going on. And one of the problems, and I know Candace and I were talking about, and I don't want to, and she was an inspiration, actually, her Franklin book for the Lincoln book is a challenge. I don't feel that these books conventional biographies are being read. I was successful with some of these books, more successful with the Dear America books that, is this making sense so far to everybody? Okay. That outsold them proportionally. I have literally gotten thousands of letters in the Dear America books. 2 on these. Why? Libraries, some are stocking them. But the point is, and it's the reason we did this, we want the kids to go, oh, what is that? I want to look at that. I want to touch that. I want to have some kind of visceral experience, which is the experience I had back at a time when there was only the book and the Honeymooners. Now, I've been rewatching the Honeymooners. Emma knows that that's a problem. As we all know, there's a lot of competition in the electronic world. So my answer to you is I think it's difficult. Lincoln's Shot has been somewhat successful. We're actually going to know in 30 days if it's successful enough that I could do its successor, which I already have in mind, which I can't tell you what it is, not to sound like an idiot, but what I'm saying is this is an opportunity for me to talk about Lincoln. First of all, it's an excuse for me to read about Lincoln for 5 years, which is great, which is partially why I'm doing it. And I think this is an attempt to entice kids. I think this is an attempt to entice kids. And I think there are other attempts. And I think Brian Selznick is an attempt to entice kids. I mean, when I look at Brian Selznick's book, you know, I still operate as an 8-year-old. I go, what is this? This is fabulous. So I think there's a challenge for us as authors. I think there's also something the matter with the libraries, the award systems, and the bookstores who completely put history and biography into second-class status. So that's an answer. Which, Candace.
How about volunteer? Here, come here. Come on. What's your name? Hold on. Can you help me open this book and show this to people? Turn around. Well, you know what? Let's open to the first two pages. Have you seen this before? You don't know me. We're not related. Now, I would personally be happy just writing about this. I'm a word person. I am not a visual person. We worked with a brilliant artist, Christopher Bing. We worked with an even more brilliant art director named Rich Dees. But you can see that this is trying to communicate in a lot of ways. Visually, the headlines, and trying to compete today for attention.
How was it? You did very well.
Does anybody else have any other questions on any? Where are you guys from? Why are you here?
We're from
New Jersey. Where?
Northern New Jersey, closer.
Closer, I'm from Dumont.
I'm a school librarian, and this is my superintendent. But we both love books, so.
Well, I'm glad you're here. You know, I mean, obviously I'm happy to hear that. And partly, one of the things I'm hoping happens is the book gets established within the school systems, with that it's a teaching tool. That was partially why it was constructed this way, that it would be useful in, if you want to do the American Revolution, do a newspaper, do articles. One of the things I did with the fifth graders at this school was we started our own newspaper. And, you know, everybody thought it was nuts. I had a lot of trouble with the teachers. They didn't want to do it. And you know what? They did it. Because it's confined. You can do assignments, go do a report on this, go do a little sports, etc. By the way, I'm going to be, I sound like now I'm on Johnny Carson. I'm going to be in Englewood on February 20th at the Lindbergh's sister-in-law, Elizabeth Morrow, with Books, Bites, and Beyond. So February 20th, you want to come by.
Yeah,
or whatever, but so. Does anybody else have any questions? What's your name?
Josanne.
Josanne. The first question, which is a question about primary sources, how to define primary sources. Candace, how would you define, can you define, primary sources, okay, all right. Well, I just, primary, well, I know you know, but I want these guys to know. Primary sources are things not written by somebody else about something. They're the original things, whether they're a letter or even a telephone call. And today, I guess email could be a primary source. I have an embarrassing omission to make, and this is a confession of my entire career. I am a devout recluse. My daughter will attest to that. I loathe leaving the house. I could go literally for months. And one of the things I always knew about my research that was bad is I don't go anywhere. I didn't go to Gettysburg. I didn't do any primary research. I don't interview people. I don't like it. And what I try to do is compensate with an enormous amount of secondary research. So I do it over and over, and so that will get, I think, to the second part of your question, which is how do you distill it, which is a great word which I love because, frankly, that's the art that I practice. And that is really, and I'll tell you an interesting experience I have. I'll answer that in a way that I find interesting, which goes back all the way to the beginning of my career, which is the following scenario takes place. I think I know what I'm doing. Okay, I'm writing a biography of Pearl Harbor, of a girl in Pearl Harbor. Or I'm doing a book on the FBI, my least favorite book I ever did, book on the FBI. Then I read 10 books and I realize, oh my God, I have no idea what I'm talking about. I don't really know what happened to Pearl Harbor. I don't even know who the FBI is. So then I read about 10 or 15 or however many books, and then I start to like get a sense of mountains over there and oceans over there, the terrain and the problem. I still don't know what happened to Pearl Harbor. Not sure I do now. And this happened with the Lincoln book, of course. I even asked Candace a question before this about Marion and Lincoln not getting married in the first time. So I then continue to do research. Maybe 60% of it is not that difficult. You can write it, it's okay. But I think about 40% of any biography is debatable. One of the things I found that in Muhammad Ali, writing a book on Muhammad Ali, who I adored then and adored now, his autobiography is the worst source you could possibly use because it's not true. So that's really the job. The job is, and we were talking about this before, the truth. No, there isn't an objective truth, but it's my job to do the best I can to distill it down as best I can. It's something that I try to do with the Lincoln book. You know, one of the things that concerns me about the Lincoln book is glorifying Lincoln. And I try to put in things that are not so glorious in the book. One of is his relationship with Mary Owens, where he was a typical jerk boy. So balance is part of the distilling process, and that's really, I think, where you earn your money as an author. And that's hard work. That's not so easy. I like it, but does that?
Yeah.
Okay. Anybody else? What's your name?
Jean.
Jean. Boy, you know, that is a really good question and something I thought about throughout writing the book. You know, I don't know, as we sit here, I don't really know. Now, sales are good and we're getting national reports, but I don't know how they break down. And I agonized. Which brings up a difficult topic, to say the least, of trying not to be, I don't know what it would be called, pro-North. It's hard to be pro-slavery. It's a real serious problem. But I try to understand the concept of the state, why Robert E. Lee identified with Virginia, which is hard for me to understand. I don't identify with New York. But I do identify with the Northeast. So I struggled in writing the book, to be fair. And as a matter of fact, I am in the, writing a number of adult books now. And one of the adult books I'm working on is called The Better Angels of Our Nature. And what it takes is a number of people who are interconnected who I feel did noble deeds during the Civil War. And it starts with Clara Barton, who I wanted to write a biography that was canceled, which is why I'm writing a Lincoln book, by the way. My Scholastic, my former publisher, canceled a biography I had written already at first draft of Clara Barton, who is an incredible, incredible woman and is not written about as much as she was when I was growing up, which is too bad. Clara Barton actually goes in the same hallway as Walt Whitman in Virginia, and they're connected to Frederick Douglass, who, of course, is more well-known. My whole point is I constantly search for Southerners to write about. And I finally found a woman named Phoebe Yates Pember, who ran the, I may be mispronouncing it, the Chimborosa Hospital in Richmond. And she was the head matron. She was from Savannah. And she was a wonderful, courageous woman. And I feel better in that I had that part. And my answer to you is, I don't know, and I wonder. I've had conversations. I don't know if you know a book, Confederacy of Confederates in the Attic? Take a look at it. It's a really interesting book, and it's a frightening book. It's contemporary. And it's he won an award for it, possibly Pulitzer Prize. Confederates in the Attic, Tony Horowitz. And I've also had some conversations with people from the South, and I get a communication of the same attitude of they're sorry the lost cause was lost, and they don't really like Lincoln any more than they did. So I don't know. I'm going to find out, and I'm sorry I don't know more. It's a good question. Anybody else? Christopher, do you want to ask me anything so that you're not – I would like you to have a good time because – when I was your age and someone was up here, I didn't have a good time. So I'd like you to have a good time. Can I answer anything? Where do you go to school?
Blanny.
Where?
Blanny.
Is that around here?
No.
Where is it? Oh, way uptown. How do you like it? Have you seen these books on Lincoln before? Are you going to stay away from them now that you've heard me?
No.
Margaret.
What was the most surprising fact you learned about Lincoln during your research?
For me, I think it was, I read a book in my research on Lincoln's melancholy by Shanks, is his last name, I can't. That I think that learning about how tortured Lincoln was, and he makes the point that which I think is brilliant, and is I think I was surprised to see that Lincoln was someone who was certainly moody. He was certainly, I don't know if I would call him depressed, but he was a melancholy guy. He was, I'm a dark person. I'm a negative person. And I really liked Shanks's view and a number of other people that Lincoln struggled through this and transcended these plagues, real problems, and became a great person despite it. So I didn't realize that at all when I began my research. I think that was my biggest surprise. My biggest little surprise is a statistic that I'll tell you, which really flips me out, which is the person I loathe the most, maybe in all of American history, is George McClellan, who I fortunately I have a friend who is a Civil War buff, so that I'm still married to my wife, who doesn't have to listen to all this. And I loathe George McClellan, who I actually consider treasonous. Some people do, most don't. And McClellan was supposedly, and we're debating this now, really loved by the troops. He was a great organizer. He was a great guy to the generals. He was autocratic and to the enlisted men. And they loved him. And Lincoln finally got rid of him, I guess, at the end of 62, if I remember. Now, in 64, Lincoln runs against McClellan for president. And up until the last weeks before the election, Lincoln certainly thought he was going to lose. His closest advisors thought he was going to lose to McClellan. Lincoln gets, I think, 78% of the soldier absentee ballots in that election. And I was stunned because that meant, and think about this, that Lincoln was communicating something to these guys who were dying, who believed in him, not all of them that believed in ending slavery, not all of them even believed in the Union that much, but he was able, in this time of just newspapers, not even photography hardly, to communicate a trust. Roosevelt, maybe, Franklin, did that, thanks to radio. Okay, that's the most surprising little statistic I found. Kate, this is Kate Waters, who is the editor on the book. Who, I don't know if you have any questions. You know, we haven't talked in a while.
Yes, I do, actually. Oh, yeah. Turn a phrase or could be tongue-in-cheek with people. And I think that's not part of his general, portrait.
Is that true?
Kids will find that very interesting.
Well, I hope so. I wanted to do more on the humor. I'll tell you my favorite little story because it really reveals a lot about Lincoln. It's not told a lot. When Lincoln... And it's also appropriate for today. I'm always interested in the attitude about going off to war. Lincoln was going home before his inauguration in 61 to visit his mother. Turns out to be the last time. He was leaving Springfield and going to visit his mother. And there were war clouds on the horizon. There was no question about it. There was going to be something. South Carolina has seceded. I can't remember if the other states, I think three or four states had, Florida, Texas. It's very serious, and people in the North were already ready for like about a three-day war where they were going to annihilate the South, and they were cheering. And at one stop, some boy in the audience said, I'm ready to lay my life down for the Union. And Lincoln said, famously, reminds me of a story. Which he always did, which was great. And the story he told was that many years ago, there was a boy who was going off to war, and his sisters wanted to be very supportive, and they made him a belt. And they said to the boy, on the belt, we're going to put victory or death. And the boy said, how about victory or gets hurt very badly? And I think all of Lincoln is there. And so, yes, I think that's a terrific part of him.
I have two questions, sort of related. As a teacher, which I haven't been for a while, but I used to share Lincoln a lot. I'm wondering if I used to hook the kids with this notion that Lincoln would put notes in his stovepipe. Is that true? Did you read that?
He kept stuff in his hat. It could be made too much of.
And
this guy, the new guy, is first? Who's first?
I don't know who's first. You said
something. No, they said that. He said it. Who, you said the second most famous president?
No.
To?
Pierce, maybe, number one.
Polk. Polk. Who is number one? I don't think based on books published, by the way. You know, I had an interesting experience. I got contacted. I was contacted by a student at Hunter High School, middle school. He emailed me. He wanted to interview me for a report he was doing on John Wilkes Booth. So I had him back out to the house. So he came out and he videotaped an interview. And what was your question? Say the question again.
Even the 5 years you thought he was second most.
Oh, I know. I got it. He said one of the questions he asked me, which really threw me. He said, "Do you think if Lincoln wasn't assassinated, he'd be as famous as he is?" And I said, "No," because there's no question that the Reconstruction years would have been hell on earth, which they were. They might have been less hell on earth. I think they're still going on today, frankly. So I think that his assassination, the martyrdom, one of the things that's interesting to follow in the story of Lincoln is how generations view Lincoln over the years from 1865 till today. The revisionism in the 60s when he wasn't the great emancipator. Now with President Obama, things changing even again. And that's a fascinating evolution.
My name is Bill.
Bill, thank you.
Could you make a few comments about Lincoln's boyhood and how he got attracted to books and what books he was reading, middle grade type books?
You know, two comments spring to mind. One is, I can't remember exactly what documentary I was watching. I think it was one, a good one, on Mary and called The House Divided, on Mary and Abe Lincoln. Very, very good documentary. And Mark Neely, I think it was on that one, who is really one of the best people to read about Lincoln, said in this moment of real insight for biographers about Lincoln, is that Lincoln's intelligence and the quality of the person who he is cannot really be figured out by his background. Meaning simply, there was just something about the guy. This was someone who was born with certain really transcendent qualities. Now, whether he went this way or that way is one thing. So I think that Lincoln just had this sponge-like reading mentality very early on and sought out very little access he had to books, which I think was driven by, which I think is what drives me. This is personal, but I should say it is, the reason I read the way I read is to figure out the world and why it works the way it works. And I'm not doing well with that. But I think Lincoln also wanted to read in order to gain knowledge. It certainly was an entertainment. And he wanted to, I think, get out from where he was, get out from his father, get out from what he saw as a road that he didn't want to be on. And books then were, up until my time, were a way out. And I think are even today. So that's what I think drove him. I think he was driven to it. Hi, welcome. I'm open to any questions, if you have any. So let us know. Margaret? I hope we do, for the sake of the other books. Because the project really had basically two parts. the choice of Christopher Bing, I think, was inspired, was made by my publisher, who's also my wife, which is bad and good, because we get to fight at home much more than we'd like. And I've admired Christopher's work before she even recommended him. And when Christopher and I met, one of the things I did before Christopher came in for the meeting is I sent him two of what I felt were my more controversial books. One, Voices from Vietnam, and two, Diary of Anne Frank, because I wanted Christopher to know what my perspective on things were. And he obviously liked them, and I obviously liked him. So from the very beginning, matter of fact, it goes till today, I got an email from Christopher this morning apologizing for, Christopher's going to be on Fox 5 News, and he gave an interview to a newspaper in Boston claiming that the whole idea was his, not mine. And he wanted to apologize to me because they left out the part that was mine. And Christopher was sincere, and he thinks the article got written badly. So throughout our relationship, there was a respect, and also I'm very not visual, and Christopher's very not word-oriented, to say the least. Then part two came up, which I call Hell on Earth, which is, okay, you've got all this art, you've got all this text, you've got all these ideas, and you know what? If you don't have a great nonfiction editor who's sitting here and a brilliant designer to orchestrate all this, because a lot of this book was made in daily decisions. An example is the headlines.
Headlines did exist throughout, I would say, 75% of the book. And then at some point when we were moving around stuff, cutting text, we came up with the idea for the headlines as sort of a compromise between more text and more visual. It kind of operates as both. So those kinds of decisions. I, frankly, don't like it. The reason I'm a writer is I like to work alone. I found it hard, but I also worked in publishing for many years. I was a marketing director for Bantam, and I was an advertising director for a small company called Barnes & Noble back then. And there is nothing greater than what comes out of working with two or three other great people. And for some reason, Kate and Rich, the art director, really were people who were like me. I'm really not easy to work with. I'm a perfectionist. And they went with me that everything just had to be exactly right. And I did no way this book would look like this if I was working alone. So it slices both ways, and I hope that answers your question. My time's almost over, so does anybody have any other questions? I'd be happy to answer them. Thank you.